This week on Making Contact.
They want definitely more options to provide for themselves, to make a living. But they also are saying that they want to be able to work in prostitution if they choose to do so.
All things must be equal before anybody can say that I have a choice.
In recent years, the international sex trade has been growing. Women are being trafficked around the world. And the backdrop of this, say many activists and scholars, is the global economy. Women's and human rights groups are now attempting to broaden the debate, addressing the full complexities of women's lives. I'm Lisa Rudman, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. To some people, the link between the global economy and an increase in sex trafficking may not be so obvious. But consider this. Over three decades, transnational corporations and international financial institutions have restructured production and investment in countries around the world. Sweeping changes in national economies have been profitable for a few wealthy elites, but have been primarily detrimental to working people. Unemployment and cuts in social services are among the outcomes. So, as families scramble to make ends meet, some women look for work in underground economies, including the sex trade. Although there is much debate and a spectrum of analyses, there are a growing number of both prostitutes' rights groups and anti-trafficking groups that are exposing the transnational aspect of the sex trade. At the same time, these groups are advocating human rights for all prostitutes, no matter how they got into the trade. Kamala Kempadu, co-editor of a book titled Global Sex Workers, Rights, Resistance, and Redefinition, spoke with Making Contact's Peggy Law about the globalization of the sex industry.
There's an increasing number of women, young women, girls and boys, in the sex trade globally.
What is the context, the social context, the political context?
It has to do, of course, with the economies of various different countries and the underdevelopment of certain sectors in those countries. And so, in the first instance, the economic situations are in third world countries are the most urgent. Women are very much pushed into formal into the informal sector. They are limited in the kind of work opportunities that they have. And prostitution is one area that seems to be very lucrative. So in terms of what's happening globally, in terms of the economic global restructuring that's really pushing women into certain sectors, and there's a closure of some areas and jobs that they're finding are things like domestic work, work in free trade zones or maquiladoras or so forth, and the sex sector.
In Burma, a military dictatorship with ties to international business has ruled since 1962. There, women and girls have limited ways to contribute to their family's survival. Ellen Bruno's video, called Sacrifice, explores the complexities of Burmese women migrating to Thailand to work in the sex trade. Some women left their homes knowing they might wind up in the Thai sex industry. Others were tricked.
There is trouble all over the country. Women return from the market to find men and boys taken away to fight the enemy's war. Door to door, the soldiers take money and rice. They come again and again. We must sell the oxen and the cart, then the fields piece by piece, until the day there is nothing more to sell.
We cannot make it living in the mountains. We are always in danger of dying. There are no doubters, nothing. I entrusted the man who brought me here. I was just a child. I was thinking of my parents. who has no money. I could only earn $8 a month in Burma. He didn't tell me anything. He said, I would babysit or wash dishes. In Burma, I used to wash dishes. I wash dishes and sometimes cook. They sold me 3 times as a virgin. I never saw any money. First for $10,000, then $800, then $400 the third time. After that, they charged $12, $10, or $6 per meal. That's all. I thought about escaping, but I did not dare try. I could not even speak the language.
In the Philippines, because of changes in the economy, many women leave the country in search of work. According to some figures, women's migrant labor, including the sex trade, is a major export of the Philippines. Additionally, global trade policies have eroded women's economic power in their home countries, according to Ninochka Roska, a Filipina writer and founder of the Gabriela Network, a U.S.-Philippines solidarity organization. Peggy Law asked Roska about how the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which established the World Trade Organization, has affected Filipino women.
So let's look at the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. You seem to be saying that this takes away many women's economic opportunities and leaves them with less choice. Could you explain that?
Well, there is a clause in the GATT, which is a 22,000-page document, a particular clause on intellectual property rights. And this seems like a very nebulous thing to connect to women, but when you consider the tribal areas in the Philippines, the knowledge of grain is something that is held by women. Now, under the GATT provision, these women can neither patent nor copyright this information, because GATT says you can only copyright or patent intellectual property if it is used for commercial purposes. Well, women, by and large, do not use their knowledge for business, for profit. Women, by and large, use their knowledge, you know, to enhance community life, the quality of life of, you know, the family, and so on. So let's say Exxon, because it will use this information on grain for commercial purposes, can patent it, and once it has patented this information, the women can no longer use that knowledge. So if you go to Hong Kong now and you look at the Filipino domestic workers there, the largest single group comes from the tribal women. It looks like it's a very nebulous connection, but it's actually a very direct one. Most people don't know is that majority of the rice and corn farmers are women. They know how to plant and harvest rice and corn. So they're going to be disenfranchised and they'll be driven to the city. They'll end up in the slums. They'll end up in the sex trade.
Roska adds that the global sex trade is built upon a history of colonialism and militarism.
Our society, despite the fact that we were under Spain for nearly 500 years, our bedrock culture, the indigenous culture, is really woman-centered. We had, for instance, no priests, only priestesses. And if a man wanted to be a religious leader or a healer, he had to wear women's clothing. So it was a very woman-centered society. Colonialism turned that upside down. But the bedrock culture persisted. The women managed the family, managed the finances of the family. And more important, they were the nodal points for the transmittal of genealogy, culture, history, tradition, etc. to the next generation. Now, when you take them out of that role and turn them into sex toys or objects of sexual pleasure, you reduce them to a one-dimensional entity. And this has impacted on the country very, very badly. Very badly, really.
And the military bases exacerbates that problem?
We had no conception of prostitution. It's not part of our worldview. We have, for instance, 150 languages. There is no word for prostitute in the language. We had to borrow the Spanish term for this. In the 1950s, when the United States started building these huge overseas bases, they had 10 reed huts within the base, inside the base, with something like half a dozen women supposed to be dancing partners for the lonely GIs. And then that thing grew and grew and grew until by the end of... by the time they pulled out of there, we had an army of prostitutes. This was something really brought to us. We have no conception of this thing, of selling sex. The nearest equivalent that I can think of in my language is, and I'm translating directly, low-flying dove. And that means the woman is not very discriminate in her partners, you know. But to sell sex? No, that's not part of our worldview.
Ninochka Roska speaking with Peggy Law. We'll have more of their discussion in a moment.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program can now be heard across the United States and Canada, and around the world on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. You can also hear us on the internet. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or you would like to learn how you can get involved with Making Contact, please give us a call. It's toll free. 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736. We also welcome comments and suggestions for future programs.
The sex trade is systematic, it is whole scale, it is organized.
Ninochka Roska of the Gabriela Network says that tourism and sex trafficking are tightly linked.
It is hooked to tourism, to airlines, to international hotel chains, and so on and so forth, to resorts, everything. And it is now the third largest illicit, quote-unquote, even though it's open, it's the third largest, most profitable in the world after the traffic in arms, the traffic in drugs, you have the traffic in women. And in terms of the number of people involved, it is the largest, something like 20 million at any given time. This is horrendous.
One of the key questions in the international debate on sex tourism and trafficking is, do women participate in the sex trade voluntarily, or are they coerced?
I think just seeing it in terms of either voluntary free choice or being trapped as being enslaved is somewhat polarizes the situation and doesn't really address the complexity of what women are actually living.
Kamala Kempadu.
There are many situations where women get trapped, if you like, in a situation of debt bondage, which means that they are in a situation where they have to actually pay off a debt to a recruiter and are stuck in that situation for a number of years, maybe some months. They have to pay off their travel costs. They have to pay an exorbitant amount for lodging, for food, protection. But they sometimes very consciously go into those situations because they know also that if they work through it, they are able to acquire some kind of money. And that kind of situation really goes beyond just talking about being enslaved or being in a situation to have to make a choice about what you want to do.
Kempadu researched this complexity in the Caribbean and Latin America.
Young women, women in general, are sort of often very consciously weighing up the kind of options they have available to them in this various parts of the world, and seeking ways to make money to, you know, provide for themselves. A sort of illustration of this would be a situation of where, in the Caribbean, for example, women from the Dominican Republic travel to another island, a Dutch island, Curaçao, and go there deliberately to work in a brothel for 3 months without telling their family back home or anything. But they would apply to go to work in a brothel and do that for 3 months and then go back home having made, you know, a substantial amount of money. And we're seeing this happening from Thailand to Japan, that even though the conditions of work that they end up in the brothels or in red light districts, are abhorrent and extremely bad, that the women do know that they can make some money there. And so sort of take the journey and take a very risky journey to actually go somewhere else and work in the sex trade.
Nonoshka Roska supports all prostitutes' rights without distinguishing between voluntary and coerced prostitution. Roska challenges what she calls the Western notion of individual free choice and says this notion of choice has no meaning given women's historical inequality.
It's a very complicated situation, so I get very angry when people say it's simply the choice of the women or it's simply that. You know, women are like at the center of an interplay of forces. Some of these forces small, like their family, you know, saying, we need to eat, we need to survive. And some of these forces are huge, you know, like the Philippine government establishing a Philippine Overseas Employment Agency, which goes around the world pimping the women. It's already like so bad in this society that when a woman puts her labor on the market, there's like a tacit, you know, idea that she's also putting her sexuality on the market. And then you're going to say, this is legitimate work. How?
Since trafficked women are often undocumented immigrants, law enforcement authorities frequently treat these women harshly. Labeled as criminals, these women suffer additional abuses, prison time, deportation, police violence, or forced return to traffickers. Internationally, there's a struggle for decriminalization. Kamala Kempadu sees this as a way to destigmatize prostitutes and trafficked women.
Sex workers are demanding a decriminalization of prostitution, which is a very important aspect. I mean, they are often pushed underground and because of that face a lot of violence. On top of that, they are advocating a destigmatization. They're fighting for a recognition as human beings. They're fighting for human rights.
There is a broad range of international activism around sex trafficking. The Gabriela Network, for example, has initiated the Purple Rose campaign to oppose sex trafficking. And the Gabriela Group in the Philippines does direct organizing with women in the sex trade and provides job training, says Nonoshka Roska.
They do organizing around issues of work conditions and situations, you know, because being against the sex trade, the existence of the sex trade does not preclude your caring for the welfare of the people who are working there. And actually what you want to do is to empower these women so they can have the choice, you know, to leave the trade if they wanted to. There are several like drop-in agencies that you can just go there if you're a working girl and say, I'm sick and tired of this thing. I want to get trained for something else.
In some countries, they're also managing to put pressure on their governments to do HIV and AIDS prevention work.
Kamala Kempadu.
organizations that I've been working with, particularly in the Caribbean and Latin American region, who are dealing with women's rights, women's human rights, are beginning also to interact and work with sex worker organizations. The ILO, in particular, the International Labor Office and Organization, based in Geneva, they have been very, very important in the last couple years in understanding sex work as a labor issue and pushing to include it as something that should be included under normal labor rights. And that will also, that also tends to alert other organizations to understanding sex work in that way, to seeing it as a labor issue. So I think these are very important steps that are being made. I think just by looking and listening to those women and what they're saying through their organizations is very important, and we're seeing that there are little steps being made. These steps are small, but I think they're always beginning, and even though we're hardly seeing the decriminalization of prostitution, we are beginning to see an international recognition of the sex trade, of the problems that it involves for women, young women, girls and boys, and that something needs to be done. Just the fact that trafficking is being talked about in the U.S. is an important step.
In fact, the U.S. Senate is currently considering a bill that addresses sex trafficking. Correspondent Lisa Horan has more.
Nearly 2 million women and girls are involved in global sex trafficking, according to one estimate, although some figures are much higher. More than half that number are trafficked to the United States. To combat this growing problem, a bill was introduced into the United States Senate in March 1999. Senate Bill S-600, sponsored by Senator Paul Wellstone, has sparked much controversy, however. Many feminists argue that its provisions fall far short of standards already set forth in international human rights law. The U.S. legislation, international in scope, is designed to provide temporary asylum for immigrant victims of the global sex trade. The bill would also provide victims 3 months to decide whether to take legal action against the traffickers, and gives victims the right to request asylum if they risk reprisal upon return to their own countries. Many domestic and international feminist groups support the introduction of this new legislation, but several key feminist organizations have also urged amendment to the bill. They argue that the definition of trafficking currently in the bill would fail to protect a substantial number of trafficking victims. Specifically, it would not protect women whose so-called consent to sale in prostitution or marriage is secured under the pressures of economic desperation or pressure from their families. For this reason, they say, the bill would shield many traffickers from prosecution. They have urged that the bill be amended to ensure that all trafficked women benefit from its provisions. The fact that Congress is considering such legislation shows that there is growing attention domestically to international sex trafficking. For Making Contact, I'm Lisa Horan.
Prior to the U.S. legislative response, international human rights organizations have been trying to halt sex trade networks by establishing international laws and pressing for strict enforcement mechanisms. As an example, a group called Global Survival Network, along with the International League for Human Rights, has focused on the trafficking of women from Russia and other former Soviet states, a population that had not previously been exposed to the sex trade. Their video, titled Bought and Sold, tells of their investigation.
In 1995, while we were investigating the illegal trade of endangered species, we came across a mafia group in the Russian Far East that was selling tiger pelts. They were also trafficking Russian women to Japan. We learned that thousands of women are trafficked every year from Russia and the newly independent states to locations throughout the world. Why haven't you heard more about the problem? Because organized criminal groups control the business, which means the women are scared, governments are involved, and the community groups working to tackle the issue lack the resources to make their voices heard. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was a time for celebration and promised new freedoms and opportunities throughout the former Eastern Bloc. However, the transition from communism to capitalism throughout Russia and Eastern Europe has led to a sharp decline in the economic status of women in the region.
80% of our unemployment is women. Industrial enterprises are closed. The problem of trafficking is the problem of small town of our country.
An acquaintance of mine told me about a possibility to work as a dancer. He told me I'd make lots of money.
Tatiana is a dancer and musician. When she was 20, she accepted an offer for a job in a cabaret in Spain.
They treated us like animals. We didn't have any rights. It was if we had a one-way passport.
Lena was trafficked to China when she was 19. She thought she would be working as a waitress and studying Chinese cooking.
They began to lock us up. There were guards everywhere. There was a balcony. You could jump if you wanted to die. They took our passports. They took them saying they needed to register us because we'd be living there a long time. They demanded $15,000 for each passport if we wanted to get it back. We went to the embassy and the consulate. They made empty promises. In reality, no one did anything to help. They just said work to earn money for the tickets. But who are we? If you don't have a visa, you don't have a right to be in the country without a visa.
The video also discusses the role of organized crime groups in Russia. The Global Survival Network views trafficking as a form of slavery and coordinates transnationally to end the sex trafficking trade. They also fight for the trafficked women themselves.
Because prostitution is generally not recognized as legitimate work, women in the sex industry are often denied the legal protections guaranteed to others.
It's a question of developing democracy. It's that also means to protect the human rights of every individual. And individuals are also women, and individuals are also prostitutes.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at international sex trafficking. This week's show has been a production of the National Radio Project's Women's Desk. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to co-producers Rosie Reyes and Lisa Horan. Also thanks to Irina Ditlovskaya for translation and voiceover assistance. Marlar U also voiced portions of the show. Ellen Bruno's video Sacrifice is available through the distributor Film Library. And the video Bought and Sold can be obtained through the Global Survival Network. Laura Levati is our managing director. Peggy Law is executive director. Our production assistant is Shireen Meraji. Norman Solomon is senior advisor. Our national producer is David Barsamian. Philip Babich is our managing producer. And I'm your host and Women's Desk coordinator, Lisa Rudman.
If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.